From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Duncan in for Beth Ruyak. In California, just like much of the world, earthquakes are a fact of life. And while most residents of the Golden State might be pretty used to the occasional short quake, rattling plates, etc., most of us prefer not to think about the next big earthquake that is certain to come one time or another. But what can science tell us about what to expect? And how can we prepare ourselves and our communities for an earthquake and the days or weeks that come after such a disaster? The host and producers of KPCC's podcast, The Big One, join Insight to discuss what they've learned about the how to survive mentality and the eventuality of California's next big earthquake. Joining us today is Misha Youssef, the senior producer of The Big One. Misha, welcome to Insight.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also joining us, Jacob Margolis. He is the host of The Big One. Hi, Jacob.
Hey.
And Arwen Champion Nix, producer as well of The Big One. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
I understand the Big One podcast reporter team has spent months interviewing seismologists, engineers, tenant rights advocates, first responders, and others about what is known and what you can do. Let's hear part of an episode. This clip comes from episode 4, The Choice.
And so we're actually taking a look at the lake and the fact that the San Andreas Fault runs right here.
Yeah.
Do you know that the San Andreas Fault runs like right? We're like basically standing on it.
Yeah.
Does that worry you at all?
No.
Why?
Yeah, I came through the Northridge quake and I can't worry about it. You know, this is my home. I chose it. So We'll have to hope that it's not as bad as it sounds like it's going to be.
Do you ever think about it?
I don't think about it. Because if you think about it, then you worry yourself to death, right?
He's got a big home, a lot of space. They overlook a scenic lake. It's 1,000 yards from the San Andreas Fault. The Big One will be really bad for him and his family. But are they really any crazier than the rest of us? We know the Big One is coming. After the quake, you won't know when the power will come back on, when the water will be safe to drink, when you'll get fresh food again, when the shaking will stop. You could lose everything. The truth is, the biggest decisions you'll have to make aren't before or during the quake. They're after. Do you stay, grit it out, try to rebuild for months and months, maybe years? Or do you say, I've hit my limit, and go? Will you even have a choice?
What's this episode about? I think it's time to go to earthquake school. So let's get going here because there's so much information. Misha, Arwen, Jacob. Misha, let's start with you. What's an earthquake, simply?
What's an earthquake? So the coolest thing about an earthquake is that the best way to understand is that it's like sound waves moving through the earth. And that's why making a podcast about it made so much sense. But when an earthquake happens, there's, you know, mild shaking and strong shaking, which causes buildings and things to fall all over the place and potentially hurt people.
Yeah, and what we're looking at specifically in this podcast is the North American and the Pacific plates slipping in the southern San Andreas, about a 200-mile range from, you know, the Salton Sea in Southern California up to a lake about 200 miles away.
So what is a normal fault?
A normal fault would be, well, so the San Andreas, for instance, is the meeting place of the Pacific and North American plates, these giant tectonic plates that are shifting all the time, that have been created over tens of millions plus that of years. And so across Southern California, we actually have over 140 different faults. And those are a result of the pressure that those two giant plates have put on each other. And so what happens is that there are little slips or not so little slips that could happen on all of these different faults. So we also, for instance, need to look out for, when it comes to a big one, the Puente Hills Fault, look out for the Newport Inglewood Fault. And, you know, we could have, there's like the Hollywood Fault that could also do a lot of damage because it's in an area of high concentration of people.
Okay, so you've been talking a little bit about the different kinds. So basically, I mean, in real simple terms, we're talking about a crack in the earth.
Well, it's a little bit more than a crack in the earth. So the way that the earth is designed or exists is that there are large chunks of land that meet at certain points. And so a fault line is that point where two pieces of land meet. So these are plate boundaries, and those chunks of land are called plates. And different kinds of fault lines have different relationships between the two chunks of land that are meeting there. So there's something called a subduction fault, where, or a subduction zone, where one piece of land moves so that it causes a tsunami. The San Andreas fault, which we're talking about, it's two pieces of land that are moving against each other almost vertically, I would
say. Yeah, so it's a strike-slip fault. The San Andreas is a strike-slip fault, meaning they move basically horizontal to one another. And so when those two gigantic plates slip, you know, we could see up to, what is it, between 6 and 20+ feet of movement on either side of that fault. And so what that means is that we have water lines, gas lines, all sorts of things that we need to survive here in Southern California that could possibly be severed. And that's really what we took a look at. There are also smaller faults like the Northridge Fault, which is, as people remember, in 1994, it's a small thrust fault that we didn't know existed, that when it did slip, it did an immense amount of damage in a very small area. So you have a lot of different kinds of faults, and they happen at the meeting of plates as well as, you know, when there's enough pressure between those two big plates, it creates kind of faults in other places as well.
So visuals are great. One of you, tell me about the pasta analogy so people can see this in their minds.
One of my favorite things was when, this is Arwen, one of the producers of the show, Jacob and I were talking about faults and trying to understand just how many there are. Because one thing we have to understand about faults in California is that we don't even know how many there are. When the Northridge quake happened, we had no idea that fault existed. And so I was trying to get him to explain it to me in a way that I, as someone who isn't a science journalist, could understand. And he basically said, take a handful of pasta and throw it on a map of California. That's how many faults we have. They're just spread out all over the place, and some of them we don't even know about yet.
I'm talking with producers Amisha Youssef and Arwen Champion-Nix, as well as host Jacob Margolis of the Big One podcast, and they're reporting on earthquake risks in California. So let's get to the meat of magnitude versus intensity. And Misha, you want to tackle that one?
I think Jacob would actually be a better person to tackle that one.
Okay,
yeah,
Jacob.
So when we talk about that, we're talking about the amount of energy, specifically when we're talking about a 7.8 magnitude earthquake, we're talking about the amount of energy that's actually released when the fault does slip. And so, as Misha said, that energy travels through the earth as sound waves and then obviously does a whole lot of shaking. And in our podcast, we spend a lot of time with instruments that also go ahead and, you know, obviously explain that a bit using
so let's talk about tricks. Yeah, let's talk about the numbers just a little bit. Everybody has an idea of what size they hear when an earthquake is reported. Is it like, wow, that's big, or that's not so big, that's minor? So how big is a big one?
Well, a big one would be a major quake. So that's going to be, I think, a 7.6 or more would be considered a big one.
Yeah, big one is more colloquial term, I think, at this point. There is actually a specific designation system that USGS puts out.
But I think what people understand is, you know, we've talked to so many people who are like, well, I can tell if it's over a 4 because that's when the car alarms will go off. Mm-hmm. Or I can tell when it's over a 5 because my glasses will rattle in my kitchen. And when we're talking about a big one, if you think about the quake that many of us think about down here in Southern California, which is the Northridge quake, it was big. It did a ton of damage. It took freeways down. That's a big magnitude quake, but you hear numbers like 6.4, 6.8 mm-hmm. around earthquakes like that. So when you hear 7.8, it doesn't mean a lot. But the big one could be 44 times more powerful than Northridge because the growth is different. It's not a small scale. The fault is different, and that's what goes into it. So when we talk big one, 6.4 might not sound big. 7.8 might not sound big, but the difference between those two is huge. You're going from car alarms going off and some damage to having, you know, thousands of fires break out.
Over a very large area, too, versus Northridge, which was very concentrated.
So when we say...
I'm sorry, go ahead. Did you just say 44 times bigger than Northridge?
44 times stronger. So that's stronger and bigger is one of those things that we dealt with in the language around this, because the semantics are really important when it comes to this kind of science. Like, bigger could imply that this is going to spread to 44 times more of a geographic zone. And it's not that. It's stronger. So stronger shaking, more powerful of a quake because the fault itself is so much larger.
And obviously, I was just going to say, if it's deep in the ocean, it might be huge, but that doesn't mean there'll be as much damage as well. So where it's located.
Yeah. Absolutely. And what Misha mentioned earlier about the subduction fault, there is a subduction zone off the coast of the Pacific Northwest that when that giant plate slips underneath that other giant plate, that's when you could see a tsunami. We don't need to worry about that as much here, but that's definitely a possibility in other places.
So when do scientists think that we will have the big one, so to speak? What is the theory, at least, or scientific theory on that?
It's roughly a 51-52% chance that it'll hit sometime over the next 30 years. However, there is, I believe, a 99% chance that we will have a 6.6 or greater size quake in Southern California over the next, how many years is it?
Soon.
Yeah, over the next 10 to 20 or so. And so they can't predict exactly when it's going to happen, but we don't say overdue, but we have gone past the average interval for a major quake on the southern San Andreas. And this is based on research by the U.S. Geological Survey. It's a specific scenario that they set out, a 7.8 magnitude quake on the southern San Andreas. And so if you look at some parts of the southern San Andreas, they, on average, slip every 150 years, and like part of it hasn't slipped for over 300. That sounds like a lot, but in terms of geologic time, that's not that many years, though the San Andreas is a very active fault. And so that's also why they went with that scenario, because the likelihood of it happening it's still pretty good, especially compared to some of the other faults in the area that don't slip but every couple thousand years possibly.
Yeah, so I think that one of the lines that sticks out to me is we were speaking with an expert and they said, I would be surprised if kids who are in school today, elementary school, didn't live through this. Like, it's going to hit in the lifetime of our children.
So before we get to, you know, what to do, because I don't think any of us are truly prepared. Maybe you guys are. Your garage is full of water right now, right?
Mine is, but it took a long time to get there, so don't feel bad if you haven't done that yet.
So tell me, in a big quake, a 7.8 scenario, about the potential damage, estimated damage, human life, et cetera, and then we'll move along to what we do.
Yeah, the shakeout scenario, which is a very specific scenario regarding the 7.8 expected or anticipated on the southern San Andreas, says that we can expect as many as 1,800 people dead, which is, you know, a larger loss of life than we've seen in an earthquake, certainly, but also qualifies this as one of the biggest, if not the biggest disaster in American history. We also expect about $200 billion in damage. That means people who won't necessarily be able to go back to work, but also buildings that have been destroyed, houses that are not covered by insurance necessarily.
Yeah, we could see 50,000 plus injuries and also 1,600 plus fires break out. And when we talked to a lot of these experts, they really emphasized how scary the fires were, because we won't have enough emergency services. And the mayor of LA says this too, we will not have enough emergency services right away to help treat everyone. And so you could be injured and sitting there and needing help and not have any help come along.
And they do anticipate that search and rescue in this scenario would go on for 19 days. So Los Angeles is an enormous city. So imagine that search and rescue going on. We don't have enough emergency responders. There are fires breaking out all over the city. There are 1,800 people who could die from this. And that's on a scenario when we have a calm day where it's not super windy and the fires aren't spreading even more. So all that without electricity, with a lot of people not having access to clean water for days or even weeks or months.
And people in buildings being trapped is also a very scary thing, because even if buildings don't come down, it could be hard for some people to get out. One of the things that happens is that after about, I think it's like 42 48 to 72 hours, you know, people start to die of dehydration being trapped in some of these buildings. And so the idea of keeping maybe some water at your desk is not a bad idea.
Okay, Misha, Arwen, and Jacob, I think you definitely have everybody's attention.
Okay.
Or they're freaked out at this point. So let's talk about what to do. This happens, and you're there. What is the first thing you should do if you feel things starting to move under your feet?
Drop, cover, and hold on. You want to make sure you get to the ground under a table or something sturdy and hold on to that table so that you're not getting thrown all over the place when the ground is shaking intensely.
Don't stand in a doorway. That is not accurate. Please don't do that.
And please don't run. Whatever you do, do not run. You could sprain your ankle, break your leg. You have to be worried about things flying off of shelves. So getting under that table and holding on is important so you can protect your head.
And
what
if
there's nothing to get under?
Well, if you're in bed and it hits, I actually had a listener follow up and ask me about this. Make sure there is nothing hanging over your bed. We had a giant mirror that was unsecured to the wall that could like tip over onto my wife. So we secured that, obviously. But you're going to be safest staying in bed if you've prepared the room around you.
And if you're in another room and you can't find anything to get under, you want to get to an interior wall of the building. You want to get away from windows and to the most interior wall of the building and stand against that.
So and you still want to crouch down and protect your head.
Yeah. Absolutely.
The largest earthquake I've been through was a 6.9. It was in Humboldt County, and I was actually covering it as a reporter, and it scared me to death. And what did I do? I got up and pulled something on and tried to get out the door as fast as I can.
And while it was shaking?
What's that?
While it was
yes,
shaking?
Yes, the pictures were going back and forth on the wall. And the bed had moved from its position out. And so I was just trying to, my brain couldn't, you know, it's middle of the night. So no, you're saying don't run and don't try to get out of the building. Is that correct?
Correct.
Absolutely. When shaking is happening, you need to wait until it stops. That said, and, you know, something to be concerned about is if you're in an office building, for instance, and you immediately go ahead to run outside, giant panes of glass will be falling off of some of those buildings. That's what we saw in the Mexico City quake in 2017. People can be killed by those. You want to make sure that things are safe and stable before you do exit and go outside.
Well, luckily I was at a, you know, a motel and the parking lot was pretty open and nothing out there,
yeah.
But it's great information for people who might be in an office building or something like that. So what if you are in a building that collapses around you?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's a terrible situation to be in. I would say make sure you keep some water under your desk at all times. If you ever get into an elevator, make sure you have a bottle of water with you. And
wow.
If you're trapped, Misha, you actually spoke to someone who had some great advice on that.
Mm-hmm. I spoke to Eric Baumgartner, who is the emergency manager in Burbank for the Burbank Fire Department. And he suggested that you preserve your voice until you hear people are actually around and are able to communicate with them. So instead, if you're trapped, try to get an object like your phone or a stick or whatever you're able to find around you and clank in rhythmic patterns, like in threes or fives, to get people's attention, because that's a human noise. That's not just like an object accidentally banging against a wall. And then when you hear people are around you, try to give them as specific directions as you possibly can. The other important piece of information is text, don't call. A lot of people are going to be rushing to their phones trying to call loved ones, and the bandwidth is going to be low. So if you send a text, you're more likely to get through than if you try to call the people that you love.
Yeah, so that text message should have as specific information in it as you possibly can give. I was in the kitchen at work when this hit. I am now trapped inside the building. You want to be very specific. And another thing, not just the bandwidth, but we could have a lot of cell towers down. So
yeah.
Communication's going to be really difficult. And send a text, say where you are, drop a pin, show the coordinates, and then turn your phone off and save the life.
And while you're at it, everyone, public service announcement, have an emergency plan worked out with your family. Because
mm-hmm.
we have fires all up and down California. This applies to fires, too, a lot of this stuff.
All right. You have survived. You're not trapped. And there's so much aftermath in a situation like this, and especially if mm-hmm. a truly big earthquake of the magnitude you guys are talking about hit. This would go on, as you mentioned, also for a long time. Who's in charge after an earthquake?
It starts at the local level. So what would it be? Garcetti. So let's say it's LA. So Garcetti would basically have to say, hey, heads up, we need help here, state. And then the state has to go, hey, federal government and other states, we need help here. And then the president ultimately has to sign a declaration of
disaster.
Disaster?
Yeah, a disaster declaration.
Yeah. And so then that's one of the reasons. I mean, that'll happen pretty quickly per city officials and state officials and FEMA officials. That said, it will likely take up to 72 hours before people start to flow in to help. And that will, I mean, it really depends on if roads are passable and if we could, train lines might be a problem. And so bringing in water on like trains could be an issue. It's going to be a mess.
So that said, you're in charge of your safety after an earthquake. You cannot depend on other people to necessarily help you. And that's why it is so important to have a plan before something like this happens.
Let's talk about that plan. What is the plan if you want to have at least the bare minimum of a survival kit, so to speak?
Oh, I love that. I've been so deep in this. It's 1 gallon of water per person per day, minimum. You should have, obviously, like cans of food, dried food, some sort of fuel to cook those things, and some sort of shelter in case, say, your apartment building, condo, or house is in trouble. And if you need extra medicine, you should have that around as well. So I'm shooting for 2 to 3 weeks. I don't know what you guys have, but I'm at 2 weeks right now.
I think what you have to understand is it's really hard to get all this stuff together. So yeah. 1 gallon of water per person per day. That's also per animal per day. And don't forget about those animals. You want to have some dog food or cat food because they're going to need it too. You're sharing your supplies with all the beings around you. So you want to have that, but try and do it a little bit at a time. Get some water every time you go to the store. You don't need to go and spend $500 right now at Costco trying to get all these things. Try and do it a little bit of a time and build up kits. And another thing that's really important is that all of your supplies aren't just in one place. I really admire what Jacob's done in getting ready because he has a kit in his car. He has a kit in his bedroom. Keeping kits in accessible places because you don't know where you're going to be when this happens is important because the last thing you want is all your cans of water and dried beans in the garage and then you can't get to it after this hits.
Not to mention the electricity's out, right? And the garage door opener doesn't work and all of the
exactly.
100%.
Yeah. So rapid fire here. What pieces of information about your life should you have tucked away somewhere that you can get to?
You should have something proving that you either own or rent the place where you live. We saw after Hurricane Katrina that a lot of homeowners had difficulty proving to FEMA and other disaster relief organizations that they own their homes, which then led to payouts being more difficult.
You also want to have a copy of your ID with you, your insurance card with you, a list like written out of your emergency contacts if someone else finds it, or maybe you don't have all the phone numbers you need memorized. You want to have those written out somewhere as well.
And when it comes to all that stuff, how to store it, you should have it printed, one. And I also have USB sticks in a couple of different places, including in my car, because in LA, we spend so much time in our cars. But one of the things that, you know, I saw FEMA after the fires in Malibu recently this past year, and they were like, yeah, it's going to take a bit for people to get any sort of help. And so any way you can streamline that process is going to be good.
Yeah, anything that you think you might need, health insurance, deed, pay stubs, contacts, back that up on the cloud if you can.
And medicine.
And lots of medicine. 30-day supply of medicine if you can do it. Try and get ahead on your prescriptions.
For you and your animals.
Yes. And if it's something like insulin, for instance, which needs to be refrigerated, I believe, sometimes or all the time, you should consider that you're going to need a generator and a small refrigerator. And so you also need to budget for that.
That is Misha Youssef, Jacob Margolis, and Arwen Champion Nix talking about the Big One podcast. So much information, you guys. Thank you so much. And there's so much more. And you can get that information on our website. I appreciate you all being on Insight.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh, thanks for having
us. Thanks, Beth.
Check out capradio.org/insight for more info. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio.